Good evening. Last time we finished off with the golden age of Spain. Tonight's lecture is entitled Rashi, Tosfos, and the Development of Ashkenazi Jewry. Hope everyone has a source sheet. Just remember, hold any questions or comments till after the lecture. And tonight I'm going to have a disclaimer. Because we'll be talking about France, and I am one of the few people in the shul that does not speak French. I take no responsibility for pronunciation. I, you know, everyone has to know what they're good at, and I'm at a severe disadvantage over here. Okay. The first question we have to ask after last week's lecture, 2 weeks ago's lecture, the last lecture, when we discussed the four captives, when we discussed the migration of the Jewish people, leaving Babylonia, as we discussed last lecture, we discussed them going to Spain, going to North Africa, going to Italy. We didn't see any Jews going to France or Germany. We did not discuss any Jews in Western Europe. So the obvious question to begin with is, how did the Jews end up in France and Germany? Indeed, Jewish legends discuss Jews being in France and Germany already at the time of Ezra. One of the kinnis, one of the lamentations that we say on Tisha B'Av is for the cities of spires, worms, and mines which were destroyed in the Crusades. And we mention that at the time of Ezra, when the Jewish people came back to rebuild the Second Temple, sent a letter to the cities called Shum, spire, worms, and Magnitia, and mines. And they sent a letter back that although we wish to be in the great Jerusalem, we're happy in our small Jerusalem in these cities, and that's why they were destroyed. That's one legend. Another legend, and this is actually brought in a footnote in Rashi, in Shoftim, is that there were Jews in France and Germany, in Ashkenaz, already before the time of the prophet Shmuel. Going way back, that some of the children of Binyamin who were killed in the civil war of the Jews, for those who don't know that, we'll have to go back to prophets a different time, 100 of them migrated to France and Germany. At any rate, there is no historical evidence of Jews in these periods in France and Germany, but that doesn't mean anything because there's very little historical evidence at all for those periods. But there is definitely historical evidence of Jews going along with the Romans as the Romans conquered Gaul, and Jews being the merchants by the lines and starting towns and developments in the Roman Empire even before the advent of Christianity. In the early Middle Ages, 5th century, 6th century of the Common Era, Gaul, Germany were inhabited primarily by the Vandals, the Huns, the Franks, the Goths, all Germanic barbarian tribes. And the Jews in France and Germany, because it was one geopolitical entity at the time, France and Germany were at one point one country under the auspices of the Franks eventually, they were in relative tranquility. And they were one community, they got along with their neighbors, relatively speaking. The first king of the Franks, Clovis I, who unified the kingdom, who's actually converted to Catholicism, and he eventually would force other Germanic tribes to take not the Arian Christianity, which I discussed earlier, which was a belief that Jesus was a prophet and not part of the Trinity, but he actually was an Essenian Catholic, and he was actually the first of the great German barbarians who believed that. Nevertheless, he was relatively amicable to the Jews, and Jews got along. So much so that the Third Council of Orleans in 539 found it necessary to warn Christians not to hang around with Jews, not to buy into Jewish superstitions. Indeed, in Paris, in the middle of the 6th century, in the city, the isle in the middle of the city, what is it called? Ile de la Cité. Again, I take no responsibility, but it was a huge synagogue in the middle of that island, which was torn down as Catholicism became entrenched and rebuilt as a church. In 629, King Dagobert basically gave the Jews a choice they would have many times. The next lecture, and I'm not going to deal with this at length, the next lecture will be entitled Crusades, Blood Libels, and the Black Plague. Well, I will deal with all of these issues much more in detail, but in the beginning here, already Jews were given a choice, the cross or death. And Dagobert basically gave them that choice, not even really offering them an option of expulsion. So by the mid-7th century until 150 years later, we will find no more trace of a Jewish presence in North and Central France. However, in Southern France, in an area called Septimania, which will eventually be called Provence, there will be a very large Jewish community, and already in the 6th and 7th century, in Narbonne and other cities, we find evidence of established, developed Jewish communities. The situation in France in general remained perilous until the reign of Pepin, the father of Charlemagne. Pepin the Short invited the Jews to come, and slowly a small amount of Jews trickled in. But it was his son, arguably the most famous king of the Middle Ages, Charlemagne, who invited the Jews to come in full force. Charlemagne granted the Jews parallel freedoms to what they had in the times of the Roman Empire, which we had discussed previously. Charlemagne saw Jewish Spain. He saw how the Moors had integrated the Jews, and he became envious of that situation. He saw that the Jews were the middle class, that the Jews developed Spain. As we discussed in the last lecture, Charlemagne wanted to replicate that in his Frankish Empire. So Charlemagne, not only did he invite Jews, he actually sent messengers to the Caliph in Baghdad to send him Jewish rabbis, knowing that if you have rabbis, you'll get laymen as well. And in fact, Jews started becoming part of the empire under Charlemagne. There are many Jewish merchants at that point. In fact, Charlemagne depended upon Jewish merchants. This would be the beginning of Jewish merchants trading from the Frankish Empire all the way into Spain, to the Moors, and into the Arabic lands, because the Jews had these connections. The Christian world, even before the Crusades, there was a disconnect with the Muslims. But as we discussed in the last lecture, in the previous lecture talking about Islam, there was always trade going on. Who were the perfect merchants? The Jews. Because if a Jew in Paris could talk to a Jew in Jerusalem, or a Jew in Baghdad, or a Jew in North Africa, and there was trust, there was credit, a Jew can go places and buy things where a Christian was not able to. Jews also became moneylenders. Now, they would not be really invested into moneylending until the 12th century, when the Third Lateran Council of the Christians forbade Catholics to moneylend for one another. Well, now they had to still have an economy, right? It's always you can have an ideal, and then you have to deal with the real life. Well, they forced the Jews to moneylend. Some Jews did it willingly, but they were also forced to moneylend. Charlemagne granted the Jews privileges. Now, this is very important to know, because we have a couple of lawyers, a couple of budding attorneys in here. We're used to our Constitution, and every American cares about their rights. You know, whether you're on the right or the left, you have your rights. What the rights are is a matter of debate. But we all have rights. In the Dark Ages, in the Middle Ages, no such thing as rights. No one had a right to anything in the world of Rome, or in the world of the Franks, or in the world of the Normans. You had privileges. Charlemagne granted the Jews privileges. A Jew couldn't just settle where he wanted. A Jew couldn't just do what he wanted. You had to have a privilege, and you had to negotiate your privileges. So Charlemagne negotiated privileges with the Jews. And in fact, for that Christian Europe world, his privileges were the most expansive. He gave them privileges to trade, to be involved in as merchants, to be involved in as the middle class. He allowed them to employ Christians, but they had to be off on Sunday. They were not allowed to trade in certain things, which was wine, grain, or currency. However, they were given general privileges, so much so that when the Normans first came to Gaul, they thought they were Jewish merchants. They assumed that the Normans were Jewish merchants. Charlemagne's son, Louis the Fair, was faithful to the principles of his father, and he granted strict protection to the Jews. And we'll see that there were those who already, again, we have to remember that the average priest and deacon following, you know, the lead of the popes were certainly not favorable to the Jews. The Merovian, Carolingian empires in France, they looked at the Jews for political and financial reasons. They were not looking on religious terms. Charlemagne did not view the Jews as religiously in his favor. He viewed them as a good pawn to build up his empire. Okay? So he would there would always be opposition from the religious leaders. So Louis the Fair gave them complete more privileges than his father. This aggravated one of the most famous French leaders of the Middle Ages, Agobard, who had drushes, he had sermons preaching against the Jews, that the Jews live in brick houses and their wives dress like the nobles' wives. How are they able to be in France? Why are they privileged in France? They should not be here. There are Frenchmen who say the same thing today. Right? But that was ready in the 9th century. And he was particularly upset when a famous incident of an individual called Bodo. Bodo was a French deacon who looked into Christianity, Catholicism, and felt it was degenerate, converted to Judaism. Now, for those who are unaware, conversion until the 20th century, I gave a lecture on conversion for the Jewish Study Network a couple of years ago. I spoke once on Shavuos here about conversion. Conversion was not at all a reality until the 20th century. And I said at the time, one of the reasons was, whether you were in the Muslim world or in the Catholic world, it was a death sentence. If you converted in Iran, even 1,000 years ago, your life was in danger. If you converted in Syria 1,000 years ago, and you left the Muslim faith, your life was in danger. Just as much so in the Catholic kingdom, that was heresy. Bodo converts to Judaism. They had to sneak this former Catholic deacon into the Muslim lands, because what do the Muslims know if a Christian converts to Judaism? They don't care. On the contrary, it's probably in Islamic thought a little bit better, not much in their thought, but definitely not a crime. But he now said, Agrobard, look at the Jews. If we let them in our land, we're going to cause conversion. Their promise is causing people to convert to Judaism. This theme would exacerbate over time. And without going into French history, after Louis the Fair, there was a civil war, and France, Gaul, and Germany actually split at that point. It's in the 9th century with the Treaty of Verdun, when the Empire of the Franks breaks up into three kingdoms, that France and Germany get permanently separated. There'd be many times tried to be united through war. Sometimes the French would win under Napoleon, and other times, like Hitler and Rahman al-Islam, the Germans would win. But that would be the last time they would truly be one country, was in 843 when it split. France would continually become more acidic for the Jews, right? Because of the clergy constantly raising the fire against the Jews. So northern and central France will continue to become really, really a dangerous situation until they get expelled under Philip the Fair. We will discuss that, and we'll discuss southern France, Provence, where, not today, a different lecture, where the Jews actually had a relative tranquility. However, Germany did not follow the path. There were many Jews in Germany in the 4th century, and we're inspired minds. In Cologne, we have literature from Jews in 321 already, and the Germans continued the path of Louis the Fair and Charlemagne following the Moors and figured that if the Jews are here, it's good for our economy. So much so that a bishop in the mid-11th century said that look at how the Jews built up spires. Appreciating the financial benefit, boon, of having these Jewish merchants and having these Jews involved in the economy as the middle class at the time. That would change with the Crusades. Of course, we know spires is one of the cities that was destroyed. It's important to note that although there were many knights involved in the Crusades, the pillaging and murdering of the Jews was not by the knights. It was by the riffraff who joined them. It was the lower classes. And we'll discuss it when we discuss the Crusades. But this bottom society would wipe out that reality in Germany. How did France and Germany develop a Torah center? We discussed how Spain became a Torah center. How did France and Germany become the Torah center that would evolve to have Rashi, evolve to have Tosus, evolve to build up all of the yeshivas today? Study the Torah of France and Germany. Right? Where did that start from? How did that develop? Reb Shlomo Luria, the famous 16th century sage in Krakow, and other scholars claim that Charlemagne himself invited the great Italian Talmudist, because we discussed last lecture that Italy had a Torah center, Reb Moshe Hazaken, and his son Colonimus. The Colonimus family from the 9th to 13th century would be overwhelmingly dominant in German life. They would be the family that would provide the rabbis, the preachers, the scholars, the sofrim. They would be the family that would lead Germany through the Crusades and help them rebuild after the Crusades. They were famous because of some of their descendants were called the Hasidi Ashkenaz. Most famous of them was Rabbi Huda HaChassid, who wrote Sefer Hasidim, which is a very esoteric book discussing a lot of like for example, the minhag not to name, to marry somebody who has their father's name or your mother's name, not to marry a girl who has your mother's name. That starts in Sefer Hasidim. A lot of other things that we do start in Sefer Hasidim. This all comes from this Colonimus family. They really built up German Jewry, and they started to have yeshivas because of them. If you want to get a picture of who they were, look at source number one. Now, source number one was written by one of their famous descendants, Elazar of Worms. Now, they would spread out not only into Germany, but into France as well. Elazar from Worms, who was also known by his work, the Rokeach. And Rokeach will become a famous Jewish last name. The Belzer Rebbe, I think you saw I had a magazine with the Rebbe of Belz, is a Rokeach. They took that last name from Rabbi Elazar of Worms, who was a colonimus. Source number one was he was writing, he was furious that sages in England and France were changing the liturgy different than his family, so he wants to prove his lineage. So we'll just look at it a little bit in the black. And I also received it from Judah HaKassi. He's talking about the liturgy, the how the Siddur should be. And I also received it from Judah HaChassid, as he received it from his father, Rabbi Shmuel HaChassid, as he received it from Rabbi Elazar HaChazan of Spire. For when Rabbi Colonimus died, his son Shmuel HaChassid was only a boy, so he gave it to Rabbi Elazar HaChazan of Spire. And when the Rabbi Shmuel HaChassid grew up, he received, look at this word, the secrets from him. And he was ordered by Rabbi Colonimus the Elder. They all received the secret of the true version of the prayers, teacher from teacher up to Abu Aaron, the son of Shmuel Nasi, who came from Babylonia because of a misadventure and had to wander from place to place as a punishment until he came to the country of Lombardy to a city called Luca, that's where Charlemagne brought in the Colonimus family from, where he found Rabbi Moses, son of Colonimus, who wrote the Piyat Emat Narascha, which is one of the liturgy we say, And he, Abu Aaron, transmitted to him all the secrets. And he continues on. The interesting thing, and this is what a lot of people discuss, I will discuss Kabbalah probably when we do the 16th century, we talk about the Arizal, is people assume one of the things that he's referring to is not only the secrets of the liturgy, but that the Kolonimus family was known to be a Kabbalistic family. That they were one of the families that had the tradition of the Zohar. So this is way before the Zohar became revealed to the masses. They were passing on secrets. We will discuss at length what these secrets are. The Kolonimus family would be the teachers of the first great, well-known German sage. His name was Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom was called Rabbeinu Gershom Maor Hagola, the light of the diaspora. If you look in the Talmud, you'll find the commentary of Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom made Mainz into a city of Torah. He became the first international Western European sage who people from the entire world, from North Africa to Spain to Babylonia, communicated with. That was Rabbeinu Gershom. He put Germany and thus France on the Torah map. Rabbeinu Gershom was famous for his making, codifying certain parts of the Talmud, making sure that the gears of the versions were correct, for his commentary on the Talmud. He was also, unfortunately, famous for sitting Shiva, mourning for his son for 2 weeks. In 1012, Mainz had one of these times where once again the option was given, the cross, your life, or expulsion. He had a son who chose the cross. And he not only sat Kaddish for 1 week, sat mourning for 1 week of Shiva, which was a typical thing. He sat mourning for 2 weeks. And he said, one for this world and one for the next. Okay? Nevertheless, Rabbeinu Gershom was, because of this, or despite of this, one of his famous edicts, bans, was about being too difficult on Jews who were forcibly converted and then wanted to return, which we will see when we discuss the Spanish Inquisition, was unfortunately a very common phenomenon. So he said, usually the old thing is somebody converted. Now, we think that conversion is, a guy puts a sword to your head, you have no choice. The reality is you do have a choice. Right? If you think about it, there are many millions of Jews over history who gave up their lives rather than choose the cross. Many millions of Jews, okay, who died rather than choose the cross. Nevertheless, I mean, it doesn't take a genius to realize that it's an overwhelming choice. And what Rabbeinu Gershom said, that even though in a sense you were breaking the cardinal rules of the Torah by following a different religion, by giving up your Judaism ostensibly, one of the three cardinal rules which necessitates giving up your life, but because it's such a difficult choice, you're under such duress, such a person should not only be taken back, but welcome back. Don't push such a person away. You know, you always look at today, we live in a world where you want to push people away who mess up. Oh, no, I've said this when Bernard Madoff messed up. No one wants to see him do tshuva. You talk people about Berman, they want him to rot. They want him to sit in jail and suffer. And they want everyone like that to sit in jail and suffer. That's how people talk. They don't want to be redeemed. Well, if your sons and daughters gave up their lives and your neighbor acted like a Catholic and lived a good life, right, you weren't going to be so friendly to the guy who did that. Here, my children gave up their lives. You come back 3 years later when the coast is clear and says, Kaiv and Aliyah, chill. I want to have Shlishi, give me Maftir, Haftorah. I'm a tzaddik. I'm coming back. What do you mean you're coming back? You acted like a Catholic. I saw you going to church. You want to come back? And the normal tendency is to not be welcoming such a people. I mean, the Gershom says someone sincerely wants to come back, you have to welcome. He's famous for other bans. His most famous ban was the ban on polygamy. Rabbi Yehuda Gershon banned polygamy. In the early 11th century, Rabbi Yehuda Gershon said it was completely forbidden to have more than one wife. That was in a time where it was accepted. And he explained that it is, although it was rare, and it did occur in people of the Talmud, these were great people who were able to fill all obligations to one. Today, it is impossible, and he therefore banned polygamy. It's a question of how long he banned it for, but the overwhelming consensus of Ashkenazic poskim is that it is eternally banned till the Messiah. He also prohibited divorcing a woman against her will. Okay? There is no such thing as no-fault divorce against your will in Judaism. A woman has to consent to get divorced, and obviously a man does. A man has to give the get. So both have to consent for divorce. This has a lot of ramifications. Rabbeinu Gershom, and you have to remember, this is when the Jewish traders forbade reading of private mail, which meant if you had a Jew take a piece of mail from a Jew in Damascus to a Jew in Mainz, you couldn't open it. It could be months on the way. Very, you know, I don't think Julian Assange could probably control himself. He wouldn't like WikiLeaks too much, but he forbade reading people's mail. On the strictest terms, and it was a curse to read someone's mail. This not only created trust, but it was also good for the Jewish economy because you had a very strong system of trust. Right? It became completely forbidden to read or look at somebody's mail. I imagine he didn't discuss it. That would apply to email today as well. This sets the stage for the eminent sage, scholar of the Middle Ages, and that is Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, Rashi would be a student of students of Rabbeinu Gershom. By the time Rashi came of age, there had been yeshivas for decades in Germany and France. Rashi, who literally means Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, Rabbi Shlomo, the son of Yitzchak, is also called Rashi, Rabin Shel Yisrael, the teacher of all of Israel. Okay? In his own life, they used to say, Rashi, Rabbeinu Sheyichya, our teacher who should live. Rashi is the teacher of all of the Jewish people, Sephardic, Ashkenazic, it doesn't make a difference. The Talmud would be a closed book without Rashi. Rashi is the one who makes the Talmud available to the entire Jewish people. He is the one who makes the Bible explainable to the entire Jewish people, as we'll see. Rashi was an only child born in Troyes in Champagne in northern France. His uncle, from his mother's side, was Shimon HaZaken, who was the chief rabbi of Mainz. Shimon was a direct student of Rabbeinu Gershon. Shimon was a disciple of Rabbeinu Gershon. Rabbeinu Gershon died the year that Rashi was born. This fits a famous Talmudic concept that when the sun sets on one great Jewish leader, it rises for another. That the year that Rabbeinu Gershon dies is the year that Rashi is born. That the Torah is eternal, as we've been discussing. The Torah, even under all, we'll discuss the next lecture when we discuss Crusades, blood libels, black play. I mean, if you were a sociologist, if you were a gambling man, the odds would have been not even one in a million. You look around, this is not going to survive. Not materially and certainly not spiritually. The Jewish people are here always, if you look at it throughout the Bible, through the Talmud, through our own time, because of our rabbis, because of our leaders. And Rashi would be the leader of the Jewish people, right, through to our day. We would not be here in Torah study if it were not for Rashi. On his father's side, Rashi was a 33rd generation descendant of Rabbi Yochanan HaSalmer, who was a descendant of Gamliel the Elder, who came from the house of David. So Rashi is a direct descendant on his father's side from the house of David, considering a large percentage of Ashkenazic Jewry are descendants of Rashi. Okay, a very large percentage, someone say up to 25% have Rashi's blood. That makes many people potential to be Mashiach. Because they're all coming from the house of David, right? Rashi it comes from the house of David. There are many legends about Rashi's birth. The first and most famous legend about Rashi's birth is that when his father, who was a vintner, now, I'm sorry to say, Binyamin, against popular opinion, and I don't want to hurt the wine, there is no proof that Rashi himself was a vintner. That Rashi himself was a winemaker.
Oh, he was from Champagne, and he had vineyards. Come on, what are the odds he wasn't?
Well, one of the reasons people presuppose that Rashi was a vintner is because he had such a knowledge about wines. When you read the responsa of Rashi, when you look at the commentary of Rashi, he was completely fluent in the winemaking process. He lived in Champagne, and his father was a vintner. That's why people presuppose that Rashi was a vintner, but there is zero proof of that. And no, there is not one piece of literature that says that, and there is no actual, you know, reason to assume that, because we know he was a Rosh Hashiva. Okay, there is no real proof of that fact. Although there are those that contend that, and it's possible he was. I'm not saying that he wasn't, but there's no actual proof of that. But his father was a vintner. His father was a winemaker. A very poor winemaker. Right? There were rich winemakers in France. I don't want any potential winemakers. There may be that. There's always a potential there. But Rashi's father was not one of them, and he lived a tough life. One day he found a jewel, and it was a precious jewel. And he was traveling to sell the jewel to London. I'm not sure where it was, in an area which was not yet had not yet become. Under the Catholic domain, in Rashi's father's time, much of England actually, and certainly the Nordic countries, were not yet Christian. So he's going to an area to sell the jewel at a higher price. And on the way, he's on the boat, and to travel, even in those days, if you were traveling far, many of the people were royal officials. They said, "We want this for our king." Now, some Jewish vintners going to this country, and they say they want it for the king. You don't have that much of a choice. He says, "Okay, but what do you want it for? You know, how much are you going to offer for? We'll offer you whatever you want. We'll give you a fantastic, fabulous price." He says, "What do you for what?" See, they told him, "We want to use it as one of the jewels in the idol of the king." So when Rashi heard, his fathers heard this, he became petrified. He's going to sell his jewel, be part of an idol. So on the boat ride, he, by mistake, dropped this jewel into the sea. So the legend says that Eliyahu HaNavi came to him and told him that because you gave up a jewel, God will bless you with a jewel with a son called Rashi. Okay, that's legend number one. Now legend number two, and you have to remember, Rashi, when you talk about the greatness of Rashi, which we'll embellish on in a minute, Rashi lived before the printing press. When, if you ever look at ancient manuscripts, how meticulous Rashi's, how the writing was, how careful. I can't imagine a human being staying up 24 hours a day for 50 years writing just without thinking the volumes of works that Rashi wrote. I mean, he had dozens of works before the printing press, right by hand, and he hand wrote these materials on 30 plus volumes of Talmud, on all 24 books of the Bible. I mean, the amount he just wrote, you're talking about a jewel, it's an understatement. The other legend about Rashi, is that his mother was walking in an alleyway in Troyes, in Worms, actually, where he was in Worms, when she was still pregnant. And anyone goes in Mea Sharim or in Jerusalem, sometimes you have to be a very talented driver. Maybe to go, if you go up to Binyamin's house, take that one-way road, very little space to get somewhere. Well, it was between two alleys in Worms, and a carriage was coming, speeding ahead, and she had nowhere to move. And she was pregnant at the time, and she was a goner. And she backed into the wall, and the legend says that the wall opened for her to go in. That's legend number two. Legends, true or not, it's because of the persona because of the fame of Rashi. Rashi is this greater than life figure who really metamorphosizes all of Talmudic study. He does the impossible for Torah study as a whole. I mean, you really have to imagine, without any tools, the depth of Rashi is unbelievable. The amount that he wrote with a quill, it's mind-boggling. It's surely mind-boggling. In an age where 1% of Europe was literate, he wrote dozens and dozens and dozens of books with quills at a higher level of Torah than any of us in our generation could even imagine. Rashi was first learned Torah by his father at the age of 5 on Shavuos. He went with his father for the first time to study. His father taught him until the age of 17. At 17, Rashi got married. Okay, and what was his marriage like? He went to yeshiva. In yeshiva, I didn't mean he came home at night. He went to yeshiva in a different town and came home 3 times a year. Came home the Yom Ha'arayim, Shavuos, and Pesach. And that was it. Okay? He was maybe 2 months a year at his house, 10 months a year in the yeshiva, first in Worms and later in Mainz. And he learned from the students of Rabbeinu Gershom. And Rashi's works begin in the yeshiva. When it gets to Mainz, for example, the yeshiva had existed for 65 years. There was already something called a kuntres, the notebooks of Mainz. You know, I mentioned how rare it was to have books. Books were very, very rare. It was painstaking work to write books. I remember the Catholic Church actually has one of the better libraries of Judaica in the world, because they pillaged and stole over the generations so many of the Jewish works and the Crusades and the expulsions. So when I was maybe 15 years old, I remember when I was in Florida, they took some of these works. And they traveled around, and you would see Rambams, Maimonides from the 13th century, Rashi's from the 11th century, and it wasn't just the words; it was the way it was written. It was mind-boggling. It was exquisite. Parenthetically, in the 20th century, we actually had works that were lost from Judaism, which we knew about, which we got back from the Catholic Church, like the Meiri, like the Avram Minahar, Avram Montpelier. These works were gone from history. We knew they existed, and the Catholic Church actually had copies of them, which we scanned in the 20th century. So Rashi took these notebooks, because what happened was there was not a Talmud for every student in the yeshiva. There was one Talmud for 25 students. They used to pass out smaller notebooks. Rashi started writing what's called a kuntres, a notebook. One of the names for Rashi's commentary on the Talmud is Kuntres, notebooks, because Rashi starts his commentary as his notes in class. Okay, Rashi becomes a Rosh Yeshiva at the age of 25, and by 1070 is a very large yeshiva. Okay, ultimately Rashi would continue. The yeshiva suffered in some of the students in 1096 with the Crusades. We'll wait to the Crusades. Let's discuss Rashi's works. Look at source number 2. Source number 2 is the great late 12th century Spanish sage, Rabbi Avram ben David, the Ravid, in his Sefer HaKabbalah. Okay? This is in the 12th century, about 120 years after Rashi, Spanish sage, Sephardic, says as follows. In France, a great light shone forth like never was envisioned by the eye before. He is the great Rav, the Chassid, Rabbeinu Shlomo of Troyes, the son of Rabbi Yitzchak. He explained the whole Torah, the whole Nevi'im prophets, the whole Ksuvim, the whole scriptures, and the 4 starim of the Talmud of Gemara, so that the reader can go through them quickly. He did not leave out anything small or large that he did not fully explain. After his commentaries went out to the world, there was not a Rav or Gaul, a great Torah sage, who studied halacha without them. Everyone after him drinks from his waters. Look at source number 3, because this will be on his commentary on the Bible. This is the Chidah, famous bibliophile, halachic sage, head of Sephardic Jewry in the late 18th century, sage from Jerusalem. Apparently Rashi wrote his commentary talking about his biblical commentary based on the secrets of the Torah, and therefore, before beginning, he fasted for 613 days, corresponding to the number of mitzvahs in the Torah. His commentary seems to deal only with the simple meaning, but his words contain supernal hints. Source number 4, great 16th century sage in Krakow, Rav Mordechai Yaffe. All of Rashi's words have a revealed and hidden meaning, and both are true. Rashi's commentary on the Tanakh, especially on the five books of Moses, is essential for companion for the study of Talmud at any level. Rashi not only explains the simple meaning, he brings in all of the Talmudic explanations, all the Medrash explanations. His nuance on the words are breathtaking, are mind-boggling. It opens the text. I mentioned once a story of a bibliophile about 25 years ago in England. I was in Cambridge, who learned Rashi script. One of the reasons why is because many of the graves in Europe use Rashi script. So once he learned Rashi script, he opened Rashi. This is before Art Scroll came around. now it's not that difficult. You can go to artscroll.com and order it online. In those days, this, you know, Anglican bibliophile learned Rashi, and as a result of going through Bible and Rashi, he had so many questions, converted. I mean, it literally changed his whole perception of the Bible. Rashi's commentary, listen to the words of the first Lubavitch Rebbe, the Baal HaTanya, who said as follows, that Rashi's commentary on the Torah is the wine of Torah. It opens the heart and uncovers one's essential love and fear of God. So you could say Rashi was a vintner. He did create a beautiful wine. That was his commentary on the Torah. Rashi's grandson, the great Rabbeinu Tam, who we'll discuss, said, I could have written my grandfather's commentary to the Talmud, but his commentary to the Bible is something unique. Rashi is what a little kindergarten student learns to the most advanced Talmudic scholars as well. It takes a person from beginning to end through Tanakh, through the Bible. It gives a person the depth of it. Especially if you learn scripture, there are very difficult passages which you cannot understand if not for Rashi cross-referencing many of the Midrash and many of the passages of Talmud and explaining it in the verses. So popular did Rashi become, and there is no regular Chumash that's made today without Rashi, okay? But not only that there's actually an obligation called Shnayim Mikra of Echad Targum, to go through the Parsha every week with a commentary. Historically, that commentary was the Targum, was Unklus. Already by the 13th century, Rabbeinu Usher, the famous sage from Germany and later Toledo, Spain, said, you can study Rashi as well. Rashi became so accepted that tens of thousands of people a week study Rashi's commentary. Now, one of the funny things that everyone knows of Rashi's script. You go to day school or yeshiva, or you start later in life and you open up any text, there's a special Rashi script. It doesn't look like a normal Hebrew bold letter script. It's a cursive, different type of Hebrew script. It's called Rashi script, so the whole world presupposes that Rashi wrote the script. That is a fallacy. Rashi never wrote in that script. Rashi's script starts in the late 15th century with the beginning of the printing press, with the Sansino family, with Daniel Bomberg, who was one of the translators, and Abraham Garden, who was the first one to translate Rashi, in order to distinguish, because Rashi was such a prolific writer, he was on every text, in order to distinguish Rashi from the text, they used a semi-cursive Sephardic script, and they called it Rashi script. So from that point on, it became known as Rashi's script. Rashi himself never wrote it. It's commentary to the Talmud. Look at source number 5. Before Rabbeinu Shlomo, the great explorer, this is from the 14th century sage, Rabbeinu Menachem ben Aaron ben Zerach in his Sefer Tzeda L'Derech, it's a 14th century sage. Before Rabbeinu Shlomo, the great explorer from the city of Troy, they learned the commentaries of Rabbeinu Gershon, which were very long. Ruach HaKodesh, divine spirit, rested on Rabbi Shlomo. Were it not for Rashi, the way of the Babylonian Talmud would have been forgotten in Israel. If Rashi on the Bible is important and essential, Rashi's commentary on Talmud it would be unimaginable to learn the Talmud without Rashi. It would be a closed book. There are other very worthy commentaries. Nachmanides has a classic commentary, not Rashi. The Ibn Ezra, the 11th century Spanish sage, has a famous commentary. There are dozens of commentaries on the Bible. Rashi is the most important. But it would still be an open book. Without Rashi, you wouldn't know where to stop on the passage. It'd be extremely difficult. Rashi takes your hand through Talmud and says, stop here, go forth here, ask a question here, right? Rashi also clarifies the text of the Talmud. There's a question of how the word should be pronounced. This is how the word is pronounced. Rashi's commentary covers almost the entire Babylonian Talmud. 30 of the 35 tractates. 5 tractates he did not finish. Means he went through it once, twice, but he was not finally edited. So his students, or his son-in-law, for example, in Makkos, on the 19th blot, it says, Rabbi Huda ben Nathan, his son-in-law, now will continue the commentary. And that's his son-in-law. Rashi has over 300 responsa by different students. One of the interesting things that Rashi is known for in a secular world, Rashi is a very well-known figure for historians, for one of the reasons is because of his Loaze Rashi. Rashi has Old French. Very often what Rashi does is he explains a concept in his day and throws in the Old French word for it. So you're always seeing Rashi referring to Old French. Well, this is invaluable because there are 3,000 translations that Rashi gives, the Hebrew translation and the Old French translation. So if anyone's into, remember, France was illiterate. You have very little literature from Old French. And you're very, very... Here Rashi translates 3,000 words and explains it to Old French. So people who study French literature and French linguistics all have to know Rashi because he is the source for a lot of that. Rashi's legacy, I mean, it's almost incomprehensible. Any student of Torah, anyone who goes to even the most rudimentary yeshiva, the first person you learn after the 24 books is Rashi, right? Rashi is our kindergarten teacher. And you start Rashi, I remember as a little kindergarten, I was learning Chumash. Rashi says so and so, and he starts explaining this. And when you get older, I was just learning something in the Talmud and Midah, Tractate Midah, I spent days on a Rashi. So last week, I spent days trying to figure out what Rashi meant in the Talmudic flow. Rashi not only is our kindergarten teacher, he's giving us our master's degrees, he's giving us our PhDs as well. Because with an advanced Talmudic scholar, you realize that Rashi is not just saying this simple explanation, he's explaining the multiple levels on a much, much higher level. All of Torah study becomes due to Rashi. Look at source number 6. This is from the interlinear translation of the Talmud by the Schoenstein edition. When they're explaining how they used the Art Scroll Talmud, which was, you know, a breathtaking one. You know, the Art Scroll Talmud is, you know, it's not only in the Vatican, obviously, has a few copies. It's known that they ordered it from Art Scroll and Cambridge and Oxford. But it's in every Jewish house. I mean, how are you going to explain the Talmud, right? We all know there are multiple levels. Look at the translation. It has been our policy throughout the Schottenstein edition of the Talmud to give Rashi's interpretation as the primary explanation of the Gemara. Since it is not possible in a work of this nature to do justice to all of the Rishonim, to all of the early commentators, we have chosen to follow the commentary most learned by the people and the one studied first by virtually all Torah scholars. In this we have followed the ways of our teachers and the Torah masters of the last 900 years, who have assigned a pride of place to Rashi's commentary and made it a point of departure for all other commentaries. There are over, on Rashi's commentary on the Bible itself, there are over 300 super commentaries. Now when I say super commentary, I'm not talking about any modern scholar. Super commentaries like the Maharal Prague, Yehuda Lowy of Prague, who if you go to Prague today, a friend of Copernicus, right, sage who wrote all the time, has a commentary on Rashi. I'm talking about the Marshal of Shlomo Luria, the great 16th century sage who wrote an Old Talmud, has a commentary on Rashi's Bible commentary. I'm talking about Rabbi Lezer Mizrahi, the great 15th century Spanish sage. Rashi's commentary is essential to all. There's also, interestingly enough, Nicholas de Liria, who Luther uses almost exclusively. This is one of the ironies of the world. Nicholas de Liria was called the Ape of Solomon. Nicholas de Liria, who was one of the foremost Franciscan friars who had commentaries on the Bible, who Luther almost exclusively uses, was called the Ape of Solomon because he so heavily relied on Rashi. It didn't stop him from being an anti-Semite, though. Like Luther. It didn't stop him from being an actual rabbi anti-Semite who tried to convert the Jews, but he used Rashi's commentary at length. Rashi dies in 1105, right after watching about a quarter of French and German Jewry be wiped out in the Great Crusades between 1096 and 1098. Jewish tradition says that when Godfrey de Bouillon went out and left France for his crusade, Rashi was, I remember when I was in law school, I used to have people stopping me, your brother is making waves. Who's my brother? Matisyahu, the popular culture figure. And this Rashi was well known. Now everyone knew who Rashi was. Okay, Maimonides was well known. These were not people in the dark. Right? This was in a religious world, in a scholastic world. Right? Rashi was the head of the Jews. He was the head of international Jewry. People knew who Rashi was. And Godfrey goes to Rashi. And the Crusades is 1096. He's going to Jerusalem. No one knew what it was going to be. And he left, he said, with tens of thousands of horsemen and knights. He says to Rashi, what's going to happen? Rashi says, you may win, but you'll come back to Troyes with two horses. And Godfrey scoffs at him. He says, if I come back with more than two horses, the first thing I'm doing is I'm coming after you. Now remember, this is while the Crusades are gone in. The first Crusade spared much of France, but clobbered Germany, clobbered spires and mines, worms. The second Crusade would be the opposite almost. It would clobber France and spare Germany, but we'll do that in the next lecture. So Jewish legend says that on Godfrey's return to France, he was left with three horses. And he was going to kill Rashi, but he had three horses. And as he came to the gates of Troyes, a brick fell down on the third horse and killed. So he had two horses left as he came in and he left Troyes. That's what Jewish legend said. Interestingly, Godfrey of Bouillon, who everyone knows was one of the heads of the First Crusade, no one knows exactly how and when he died. Most historians presuppose he died in the year 1100 at a young age in Jerusalem. That's how the history books have it. Rashi is buried in Troyes. Nobody knows exactly where he's buried. In the middle of Troyes, there is a shin, believe it or not, most of that was put up about a dozen two years ago to symbolize Rashi, where they think he was buried. But despite the fact that we have no grave from Rashi, Rashi is buried in every heart of every Torah scholar, wherever they may be. Rashi is also famous for his daughters. Rashi's daughters were married to the greatest scholars, and that's how the house of Rashi continued. Rashi had definitely two, but probably three daughters. His older two daughters, which are most famous, were named Yocheved and Miriam. Yocheved was married to Meir of Ramaport. Meir had four sons, all of them great scholars. The first was the Rivam Yitzchak, who died a lot young, but was quoted proficiously in Tosfos with the Rivam. He had died with seven orphans at a young age. The second son was the Rashbam. Rashbam's commentary on the Bible is one of the most famous commentaries. He actually finished the Rashi in Baba Basra and is essential in other tractates. He had a third son, Shlomo, grandson from Yocheved Shlomo, who was named after his grandfather, who was a grammarian. But his fourth son is Rabbeinu Tam, who was the most famous of all of the Tosfos, which we'll discuss in a minute, who was famous. He also, Yocheved, had a daughter named Chana, who married a great scholar, and his Chana is one of the sources for some of the teachings of Rashi. She's quoted as, because she was part of this house, she knew exactly what went on. Her son was probably the second most famous scholar of Tosfos, called the Rimi Dampier, Rabbeinu Yitzchak. If you look at Tosfos, the Rabbi Yitzchak is quoted hundreds and hundreds of times throughout the Talmud. She had another daughter married to a Sham Shimshin ben Yosef, who's also a Tosfos. His second daughter was married to Yehuda ben Nasan. He established yeshiva as well. There's a third daughter, which may or may not have lived. People say her name was Rachel. She probably did live because there are a couple of proofs in a third daughter. One of them, he has a responsa. We talked about a daughter. This is who is not Miriam Yocheved, where his daughter, this daughter, lost a valuable ring. Okay, it's actually an interesting responsa, tshuva. And Rashi says that even though the Talmud says that if a child damages something, the child's not liable and the parent's not liable. Happens to be, that's liable in this world. The Talmud says that if a child gets older, they should ideally pay it back. But Rashi says, of course I'm going to pay it back. But really a child in Jewish law, in theory, if the parent's not there, the parent is responsible for the child, the child's out and about, and the parent and by mistake does something, the child's not liable for acts of mistake. And Rashi says, I of course paid back for this ring of this little girl. Well, his older two girls were married already, so that's one of the proofs he had a third daughter. There are lots of legends about Rashi's daughters, okay? The most well-known and the most likely to be true is that they were very, very learned in Torah. They grew up in houses filled with Torah study, okay? The Shiboli Leket says that there were times when Rashi was writing and he got tired and he asked his daughters to write down for him. Now remember, you're talking about an age with less than 1% of Europe was literate. His daughters are writing down complex Torah things and Rashi dictating it to them. They were Torah scholars. There's one legend, hard to believe, that they wrote the Nedarim is the one tractate which no one knows who finished it for Rashi, that his daughters did that. There's actually no proof. The other famous legend of his daughters is that they wore tefillin, right? That Rashi's daughters wore tefillin. Happens to be the Shulchan Aruch codifies that girls do not wear tefillin. It's against a breach of contemporary Jewish law. But there were unquestionably ladies who did wear tefillin hundreds of thousands of years ago because there were commentaries who discuss it. Rabbeinu Tam himself feels that it'll be permissible. Okay, that opinion is not accepted in halacha. It's beyond the scope to discuss the laws of tefillin for ladies. But Rabbeinu Tam felt this way. So what do people say? Rabbeinu Tam held women who wear tefillin. Rashi's daughters were very learned. There were women who wore it at age. That equals Rashi's daughters must have wore tefillin. There's actually no proof for that. It's hypothesis. But that's one of the legends that they wore tefillin. These sons and grandsons developed the school called Tosfos. If you look at any Talmud, if you look at the inside of the margin, wherever you're going to be, the inside of the margin on the side of the Talmud is always Rashi, and the outside of the margin is going to be Tosfos. So you have, facing the margin is Rashi, then the Talmud, then Tosfos. And all Shas, that's how it is. Tosfos were from the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, and the students, and their students, who developed Rashi's commentary and took it a stage further. Tosfos analyzed not only Rashi, how Rashi interfaces with the rest of Talmud and with the rest of Medrash, but the text itself. And they really built upon it. Tosfos literally means additions. I mean, they added on to Rashi. But what Tosfos really is, they created a whole new entity of Talmudic analysis. Any student of Talmud knows that if you want to sharpen your mind, you start learning Tosfos. Because you can learn the Talmud at one level, but once you're in the Talmud, you do the Sea of Talmud, You can start cross-referencing. Well, how does, if this is true on this page, on this folio of Talmud, how does that make sense? And guess what? Then you learn a different Talmud, and you say, how does this make sense? And it will always overlap, and Tosus is there trying to work all of this out. Tosus, the school of Tosus, goes for 200 years. Now, you know, I remember, you know, when I came to law school, they're very into the Socratic method, and they're very proud of it, and, you know, of levels of understanding a text. And I have to be honest, I mean, it was very simple when you, you know, for somebody who came out of yeshiva, the level of Talmudic understanding was a much, much, much higher level and scope of depth. And Tosus is going to take you and cross-reference all of Talmud, and the levels of multiple hair-splitting of Tosus is breathtaking, right? These schools went on for 200 years, primarily in France and Germany, but there were Tosus in Spain and England as well. Ultimately, I'm not going to go through the whole history of Tosus. Tosus ends in the 13th century, late 13th century, with the crushing of parts of Spanish Jewry, but more the point of French Jewry when they were expelled, where German Jewry was under tremendous duress, when you had German scholars fleeing in all directions, to the south, to Spain, and that's how Poland and Lithuania would start to be developed. They were forcibly closed, like the Jerusalem Talmud we discussed with the conversion of Constantine. Tosus' school closes to a large extent. I can give a whole lesson just on who the Bali Tosus are, but I want to pick one, and that is Rabbeinu Tam. There are literally dozens of famous Bali Tosus, famous scholars of Tosus. Rabbeinu Tam was the leading Tosfos. He was a grandson of Rashi. He was not only a great, great Torah scholar, the leader of the generation, he was a very affluent individual. He was a moneylender. He had a house of 40 rooms in the 12th century. Okay, there's no question he was an extraordinarily wealthy person. He knew all the nobility, and when we discussed the Crusades, he actually was attacked during the Second Crusade, stabbed 5 times, almost killed, but one of his noble knight friends saved his life. Okay? Rabbeinu Tam was a strong leader. He has letters to other halakhic sages where he doesn't just speak strongly, he threatens to excommunicate them. I mean, if you read his letters, he felt that he was the greatest sage of the generation. It was no holds barred. And he felt he was the bearer of the tradition. Truth be told, he is considered of that age the greatest sage. He probably made the greatest impact on Talmudic study, and his traditions are kept down to this day. There are two famous halachic disputes that he had with his grandfather, with Rashi. There's a famous legend that when he was a little boy, on Rashi's lap, Rashi would very often study with his tefillin on. And he grabbed onto his grandfather's tefillin sitting on his lap. And Rashi chuckled and said, one day he'll argue with me about tefillin. Right? One day he'll argue with me about tefillin. We all know that the main tefillin that we wear are Rashi, but there are certain Hasidic Jews that wear Rabbeinu Tam as well. Everyone wears Rashi tefillin. But certain Hasidic Jews, you know, the Baal Shem Tov said everyone should try to wear it. Chabad will all put it on, but all Hasidim put on two pairs of tefillin. They put on Rashi tefillin or Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. There's one difference and only one difference of the two. The boxes are the same, the colors are the same, the letters are the same, everything is the exact same. One difference. And that, and the four scripts that are in there, the four parshas, the four sections of the Bible are the same, but the order of the four are different between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. Rashi held one order, and Rabbeinu Tam held another order. And the order is important. Interestingly enough, it's not, this isn't starting with Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, it's actually Midrashim going back, and they have historical evidence going hundreds of years before Rabbeinu Tam, okay, that of finding both Rashi tefillin and Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. And there's a famous story, I think in the 50s, they found a thing of tefillin, and they found it before also, and they found, like, thrown away, and I think they were all Rabbeinu Tam tefillin, if I remember correctly. And so the student people who put on Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin as well as Rashi said, we have a proof. They wore Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin. So, you know, the other argument was, not at all. Those are the tefillin they threw out. That's why they're all put over there. Those are the bad tefillin. So it predates them, but it became famous as Rabbeinu Tam versus Rashi. The other famous halachic dispute between Rabbeinu Tam and his grandfather Rashi was that Rabbeinu Tam held that the mezuzah should be slanted horizontally, and Rashi held vertically. So Rabbeinu Tam held horizontal, Rashi held vertical. Ashkenaz Jewry today puts it on a slant to get both Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi. The reason our mezuzah are slanted in is because Rabbeinu Tam held horizontal, Rashi held vertical. Okay, they held the mezuzah. Svardic Jewry, except for Moroccan, all Svardic Jewry follow Rashi, and the Maimonides hold the same way, and they have it vertical. If you go to a Svardic Jew's house who knows anything about Jewish law, it's supposed to be vertical. Okay, Moroccan Jews who were close to other parts of Europe follow the general Ashkenazi custom, which was to put it slanted to get Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi as well. One of the reasons why they have the same debate by how a Sefer Torah should be stored in an Aron. Rashi held vertical, Rabbeinu Tam actually held you should put the Sefer Torah flat in the Aron. We try to have it on a little bit of a slant as well. If you look how a Sefer to put, it's not put in a holder. We try to slant it a little bit to get both opinions. Rabbeinu Tam was also a poet, so much so that, remember we discussed Spanish Jewry, how there were poets and there were grammarians. So when the famous Ibn Ezra, Avram Ibn Ezra, met Rabbeinu Tam, he said, have the poets in Spain made their way to France? Because France and Germany were known for their Talmudic analysis scholars. The Spaniards were poetic, they were philosophical, which we'll discuss in a moment. But Rabbeinu Tam was multi-talented. He was a true Renaissance man. He supported Torah. He was the leader of the generation. He was known to all the nobility of France. They needed a loan. They needed to come to him. And he was a very well-known individual. Rabbeinu Tam wrote a famous book called Sefer HaYasher. But by the end of Rabbeinu Tam's life, life became extremely difficult for the Jews, so much so that there was a massacre in Blois just a few weeks before he died, and he declared a fast day. That's within the 20th of Sivan, which for generations people fasted on that day as well. I would like to have two exercises at the end of this lecture. The first is, I remember when I was younger. This was many years. I mean, many, many years. I mean, it can't be that many years, but it was many years, right? Many years back. I was sitting in yeshiva with, you know, with my friends, and we're, you know, when you're young, you have silly arguments, and we're discussing who was greater, Rashi or Rambam. Because arguably, those were the two most important sages of the Middle Ages, and really the past 1,000 years. And I remember, if I remember correctly, I felt the Rambam. I argued that Rambam was greater than Rashi, and I had at least 4 people against me, at least 5 people, and they went to the Rosh Yeshiva, and they said, we like a serious question, who's really bigger, Rashi or the Rambam? And he looks at us like, that was a good lesson to, there's more serious arguments to have, and really couldn't weigh out who's actually greater, Rashi or the Rambam. When you get older, you don't think who's greater, because we can't figure that out. They're both equally great and equally important. But when you get older, you ask yourself, not who's greater, but what's the difference? Rashi and Rambam had a very, very unique paths. And they did a lot of things. In 2 lectures from now, we'll discuss Maimonides and his life, his works, and his post-life controversy at times and greatness. But for now, I want to just jump to Maimonides to compare and contrast him to Rashi. Rashi's goal in his commentaries was to allow the layman, scholar, and child to have better access to the Chumash and the Talmud. Therefore, if you look at Rashi's commentary throughout, he's constantly explaining words, phrases. Right? The Rambam does nothing of that. The Rambam is most famous. His greatest contribution, forgetting the Guide to the Perplexed, which was very important, or his commentary on Mishnah, which is very important. We'll discuss that when we discuss the Maimonides. And he had the first major commentary on Mishnah. But the most famous work of the Rambam, and the thing which all the Jewish people are indebted, is his Mishnah Torah, his Yad HaChazakah, where he systematically codifies all of biblical law, Torah law, contract law, property law, laws of sacrifice. I mean, it is mind-boggling to have a code of Jewish work like this. And the levels of understanding of Maimonides is breathtaking. You have scholars to this day spending weeks on a Rambam. The greatest scholars' focus, the focuses of yeshivas, is on Maimonides. The whole brisk and mir, they focus, what does the Rambam say? How does Maimonides fit with the Talmud? And that Rambam systematically codified all of Jewish law. He was the first one to do it. Because if you learn Tosfos, Tosfos' analysis is unbelievable, but to know what Tosfos holds about the black letter law of property, you have to start, I have to look at Tosfos here, I have to look at Tosfos, I have to go fishing to figure out, get a clear picture. The Rambam puts it all together, crystallizes all the Talmud in a systematic way. Part of the reason that Rashi had his path and the Rambam, Maimonides, had his, was not merely because of the personality, it was because of the cultures from where they came. As you know, Rashi really was instrumental in the development of Ashkenazic Jewry, and the Rambam was a product of Spain, later North Africa, of all of the Sephardic great Torah scholars. Generally speaking, as a general rule, when you look at all of the Middle Age commentaries, and there are dozens and dozens and hundreds of works, the Sephardic commentators looked at the broad picture of Judaism. They looked at the forest and not at the trees. The Ashkenazim were very into the nitty gritty textual analysis. What does this word mean? How does this word make sense? How does it fit? Where the Sephardim were trying to figure out, how does this philosophically make sense? Where does this fit into the larger picture? Therefore, Rashi's commentary were quintessentially systematic or philosophical intellectual nature, Rambam's commentary, and Rashi takes you by your hand through the Talmud, through the 24 books of Scripture. These differences did not grow up in a vacuum. I don't want to rehash things we spoke about previously, but suffice it to say that the Sephardic world, particularly under the Moors in Spain and in North Africa, till the Almohads came, was a very open society. It was the most advanced society of the time. Right? The Jewish people, when they looked at their neighbors in the middle and upper classes in the Sephardic Muslim Moorish world, they looked at them with respect. They had a certain broadness to them, which is why when we discussed the Golden Age of Spanish Jewry, we talked about their involvement not only in Jewish thought and culture, but in general Spanish and Muslim thought and culture. The Ashkenazic Jew, on the other hand, was living in a Europe, in a Christian Europe, with a 1% literacy rate, where even Charlemagne, who was relatively progressive, enlightened for his time, couldn't write his name. They did not look at the nobility, who were drunken, you know, low-life knights for the most part, with respect, and they certainly did not look at the peasants around them. They did not appreciate the culture around them, that's clear. They became much more insular, focused on what does the text say. Christianity, you know, basically ostracized the Ashkenazic Jewry from its life. It became very superstitious, especially after the Black Plagues. Ashkenazic Jewry is very inwards bound. They focused on their text and didn't think how it fits on a broader level. Which brings me to my second excursus. That was just a basic difference between Rashi and Rambam, which is important to know. When we learn Rambam, we'll see how the mind is how he learns. And my second excursus, and with this we'll end, is Ashkenazic Jewry itself. You know, I discussed the last lecture, the you know, people ask, what's Sephardic Jewry, what's Ashkenazic Jewry? So I said that the Chovas Levos, Rabbeinu Bachya, who himself was a Sephardi in Saragossa in the 11th century, said that Ashkenazic Jewry are Jews in Christian lands, Sephardic Jewry are Jews in Muslim lands. That's why even though Sfard means Spain, it doesn't just Sfard is not just Spain. Most of Yemenite, Persian, Baghdadi, Aleppo, from Syria Jews never had any connection with Spain. But Sephardic Jews were Jews in the Sephardic, in the Muslim lands, whereas Ashkenazi were in Christian lands. So the name Ashkenaz originally were given to Jews in Shum, in Spires, Mainz, and Magnesia. Italian Jew will be a third group, which eventually will be subsumed under Ashkenazic and Sephardic culture. There'd still be a little Italian niche of itself. But where Ashkenaz would start in the Rhineland and would spread eastwards into Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, Belarusia, and Russia as Jews were forced out after the Crusades and they took their Yiddish language with them. In the 11th century, there's a very interesting piece. I once read an article by Rabbi Daniel Elazar of the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs, where he documents that in the 11th century, 3% of world Jewry was Ashkenaz, 97% was Sfard. What does that mean? Ashkenazic Jewry didn't come from nowhere. You know, they came from that. But in Christian Europe, there were 3% of worldwide Jewry. And in Muslim countries, there are 97%. In the mid-17th century, Sephardim still outnumbered Ashkenazim 3-2. But by the end of the 18th century, Ashkenazim outnumbered Sephardim 3-2. By 1931, 92% of world Jewry was Ashkenazic. Okay? By 1750, America had been majority Ashkenazic. By 1931, I think 98% of America, United States of America, was Ashkenazic. Post-Holocaust, about 75-80% of worldwide Jewry is Ashkenazic. In Israel, it's about a 50-50 split. Where did this word Ashkenaz come? Ashkenaz, what does it mean to be Ashkenaz? Where did the usage of the word come from? Okay? We already find references in the 9th century to Ashkenaz. Remember we read that letter from Chasdei Ibn Shaprut to the Khazar king? They were already using the terminology of Ashkenaz. Okay? Ashkenaz is actually a word in Tanakh, which is one of the sons of Gomer. It was the son of Gomer, who was a grandson of Yefet. Gomer in Jewish tradition is Germany. Gomer would develop to Germany. And you see already by the 9th, 10th, Rav Haigon's writing to the sages of Ashkenaz. Okay? The Machzor Vitri talks about Ashkenaz. The 13th century, almost every reference to non-Sephardic Jewry is to the Jews of Ashkenaz, whether they were in France or Germany or later other places. By, now, sometimes we say in the Nusach of Ashkenaz is all Jewry, but sometimes I refer to the Jews of Germany. That's, in some literature they use it, but it became the Jews of all Christian country Jews became Ashkenaz because it starts primarily in that Rhineland area. Over time, Ashkenazic and Sephardic Jewry developed very differently because I discussed last time, when everyone is in Babylonia, there is no differences, significant differences, cultures and customs. And yes, in the Ashkenazic world, you have, especially the last 3 centuries with the Hasidic movement and different countries, Hungarians having nuances and Polish nuances and Lithuanian nuances and Russian nuances. In the Sephardic world, the Yemenite Jews have different customs than the Persian Jews and certainly than the Moroccan Jews who had a very, Moroccan Jews, certain things they have Ashkenazic, believe it or not, because they had a big crossover. They're closest to Europe, and if you're in Morocco, they had a big crossover. The Yemenite Jews were secluded. They had nothing, they didn't know what Ashkenaz was. They barely had any contact with these people. Right? But you'll find different country customs in the Sephardic world and Ashkenazic world. But there are fundamental differences in customs, liturgy, between Ashkenaz and Sephardim. Certainly Ashkenazim follow the Ramah, Moshe Isserles, which we'll discuss, and Sfarim follow the Shulchan Aruch. There are no difference in actual commandments or dogmas, anything of the sort, but there are differences in customs. For example, everyone knows on Pesach, you're jealous of the Sephardim. They get to have kitnias, they get to have rice and corn, and we have get to have potatoes. Sephardim never had the custom of kitnias. Ashkenazim, though, we get to have, what kind of Ashkenazim have bagels and lox and cream cheese? We had fish and milk. Many Sephardim, going back to the 11th century, don't eat fish and milk together. They can't have lox and cream cheese. Can you imagine a Jew can't have lox and cream cheese? Okay? Well, in Persia, they didn't have lox, so they didn't lose out. You know, but they eat their catfish, or whatever, cat's not kosher. They eat their fish. They eat their fish with milk. Okay? The minhag in Baghdad and other places, I'm not going to discuss the halachic reasons why, they did not have fish and milk together. Kashrus of meat. There's Beis Yosef meat. Okay? They have certain things as far as lesions, which are more stringent. On the other hand, they will take out the sciatic nerve much more easily, and therefore, Sephardim will eat the back half of a cow, where Ashkenazim will stay away from. Okay, they had a different melicha process. Ashkenazim put their tefillin on standing, Sephardim put their tefillin on sitting. Ashkenazim, this is one of the main differences, pronounce Hebrew, the tufts and the suffs differently, which is the correct way. Even Sephardim will admit that. If you look at the actual test, we have a Masorah that way. Sephardim do not. They have the Sephardim also mess up on comments and patachs. Everything for them is a patach. They don't know what a comments is. Okay? Unfortunately, Israel took the Sephardic pronunciation because you have to remember, who founded Israel? Ashkenazim Jews, you know, Ashkenazim, you know, not only the most popular, the most troublesome in most levels, you know, every secular movement in the past 300 years, and discuss modern contemporary Judaism, well, Ashkenazim rebelled against their parents. When the Zionism movement started, it was not just to move to Israel, it was a rebellion. You know, Zionism was overwhelmingly secular, and a lot of it were kids who ran away from home. And they were running away from Yiddish. And everything to do with Ashkenazim, their parents and the shtetls, and they took the Sephardic pronunciation. The Sephardim, though, have a better ayin and aleph. They will distinguish ayin and aleph. Ashkenazim have no capacity to do that. They do comments katan. Ashkenazim have no capacity. Little fall, you have a little Sephardi blood, you do comments katans. Generally, Ashkenazim do not do comments katans. A talis. Ashkenazim put on a talis when they get married. Except for Chabad. Okay? Ashkenazim put on a talis when they get married. Sephardim put on, actually, I should say, except for Chabad and German Jews. German Jews. Pure German, Yekes, put on a talis when they become bar mitzvah. But the vast majority, 90% of Ashkenazi Jewry, put on a talis when they get married. Sephardim put on the talis for sure by bar mitzvah, but sometimes even when they're younger to train them in. And another fundamental difference, I'm sorry for all the Sephardic ladies, is that in theory, Sephardim are still permitted for polygamy. Okay? They did not accept the ban of Gershon until, you know, the 19th century. There were Sephardic communities where the men had more than one wife. I mean, they lived in Arabic countries where this was rampant. It was not common in Sephardic world. I certainly don't think it was common, but it is permitted. I don't think where anywhere Sephardim live today in the state of Israel, it's not legal. France, it's not legal. America, it's not legal. And it's certainly not wise in our world, in our society, to even ponder an idea. But in theory, they are permitted in polygamy. And now that until maybe 100 years ago, it was common. And in Yemen to this day, there are individuals with more than one wife, something Ashkenazic Jewry has not seen for 1,000 years. Ashkenazic Jew also became Ashkenazi, is a way of prayer, whereas the Sephardic has a different liturgy. The Sephardic liturgy will take a lot more of the Kabbalah into liturgy. In the Ashkenazic world, though, believe it or not, Nusach Sephard does not mean Sephardic. The Sephardim daven Edut Mizrach. Nusach Sephard is Hasidim who daven with Kabbalistic influences of the Arizal, and there is a fourth one called Nusach Ari, which is what Chabad davens. Okay, believe it or not, the army of Israel davened Nusach Ari. Why is that? Because they didn't want to have to decide between Ashkenaz and the Sephardim, so they made nobody happy, And he's not doing the Sukhari to get out of it. Okay? I mean, maybe 0.2% of the Israeli army actually davened. So, most people have siddurs that davened what they want. But the official army in Nusach is that. Interestingly enough, the last name Ashkenazi are found by almost no Ashkenazim, but by many Sephardi. For me, many, many Syrian Jews, after, you know, Gindi or whatever last name, my name is, you know, Yosef Ashkenazi, Vladimir Ashkenazi, this Ashkenazi, the Sephardic. Why is that? Because those were descendants of Ashkenazim who moved to Syria or to Baghdad, took on Sephardic customs, but kept the name, last name Ashkenazi, to tell you their roots. The old custom, wherever you moved to, you merged into. You left being an Ashkenazi if you moved to Damascus or Baghdad or to Casablanca, and you left being a Sephardi if you moved to Krakow or Budapest or Odessa. That was how the world was. You know, I discussed, when we discussed the Khazars, the ludicrousness of, you know, I really went through it in detail, of the modern-day anti-Semite canard that a lot of Ashkenazim came from the Khazars and these type of things. But I want to just end with this. The interesting thing of it all, when you look at Rashi, look at the way the sages, Sephardic sages, spoke about Rashi and Ashkenazim, or you look at the way the Ashkenazim referred to the Sephardim, going back to when the division begins, they never questioned the Jewishness of the Sephardim or the Jewishness of the Ashkenazim. They freely married, and they never questioned the customs. It always was that the Ashkenazim had their customs. If you look at the Shulchan Aruch, they'll say, in the European countries they did this. And if you look at the Amar, they say, in the Sephardic countries they did this. It was always one of mutual respect. And that's how Torah is built, and that's how Jewish people will maintain itself. Next lecture will be on the Crusades, the blood libels, and the Black Plague. Thank you.